Hello and welcome to the first episode of the new season of the Beverage Report podcast. This episode, we interview Baroness Dambisa Moyo and discuss a wide range of topics such as inflation, interest rates, climate change, AI and more, as well as Lady Moyo's illustrious career. Baroness Dambisa Moyo of Knightsbridge is a member of the United Kingdom's House of Lords. She is a principal of Versacre Investments, a family office focused on growth investing globally, and she also serves on a number of global corporate boards, including Chevron, Condé Nast, and the Oxford University Endowment Investment Committee. Her areas of interest are capital allocation, risk, and ESG matters. Dambisa is the author of 5 best-selling books on the global macroeconomy and geopolitics, and she holds a PhD in economics from Oxford University, as well as a master's degree from Harvard University. Special thanks for this episode goes to Jacinta and the wider Beverage Report community, as well as the LSE Department of Economics. We are delighted to have you on our podcast today, and thank you for joining us. Jumping straight in, the growth projection issued by the IMF suggests that growth is expected to remain at a sluggish 3% this year and decline to 2.9% next year. Are there any countries or regions that you predict will defy this trend with robust growth prospects?
So you're absolutely right. The IMF has reaffirmed essentially what is a slow and low economic growth outlook for around the world over the next several years. I think what's really important is in order for a country to double per capita incomes in one generation, so really to put a dent in poverty, we need to be growing by 3% per year. There are many countries that are not growing at that rate. So many developed countries, as you know, Germany is in a recession. Britain has very anemic growth across Europe. In the United States, it's been relatively weak. And then also in the emerging markets, the so-called BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, have also seen a slowdown in economic growth. There are countries around the world that are close or above the 3% number, but it's not consistent. And so to answer your question, it's very unlikely that you will see a solid growth performance by different countries if the broader economic environment globally, because of trade slowdowns, because of capital flows reductions, because of the two wars and issues around inflation, you will unlikely to see high sustained growth around the world. Of course, as I said a moment ago, you could see aberrations to that. But if we're looking for sustained economic growth on a structural basis, you need to have, you know, a lot of investment, a lot of trade, a lot of sort of aspects of globalization that have been deteriorating over the last several years. And we don't really expect that those things will be turning around anytime soon.
Right, and you've mentioned inflation. So given current global inflationary pressures, when do you think we will return to a lower inflation environment? And what measures could be pivotal in getting the economy there?
Yeah, so inflation is extremely hard to stamp out. I attended the Jackson Hole Federal Reserve meeting in August, and I have attended that meeting many times over the last 10 years. But it was particularly stark that the Fed Chairman, Jay Powell, reminded us last year in 2022 that getting rid of inflation, once it takes hold in consumer and individual expectations, but also in the economy, is incredibly difficult. As a reminder, in the 1980s, when there was high inflation, Paul Volcker had to raise interest rates to 20% in order to kill off the inflation. And even then, that a very aggressive policy stance came after about a decade, so 10 years of trying to get rid of inflation. As you know, the Federal Reserve in the United States, the Bank of England in the UK, and many other central bank or, organizations, central banks, have a target of trying to get back to a 2% inflation rate. In no country, sort of the ones I've, certainly not the ones I've mentioned, have we yet got to that rate. So it's impossible for me to answer the specific time when we will see a material decline to the point of the 2% target. The good news is that we have already seen that the 500 basis point increase, so up to where we are now at 5.25%, 5% interest rates, both in the UK, but also in the US and elsewhere around the world, the ECB, et cetera, have definitely dampened inflation around the world. And we're no longer in the double digits or high single digits that we saw in the past year. But we're still not at the 2% that we would like to see. You know, more generally, there are a lot of exogenous factors that are driving the inflation environment. Obviously, as I mentioned, the war between Russia and Ukraine, the instability in the Middle East from Israel and Gaza. These aspects create pressures of food delivery, but also pricing of energy products that you know, as you know, we're consuming 100 million barrels of oil every day in the world. And in order to have that type of global system, you know, when we have shocks from a war, for example, but also from supply chain disruption from the pandemic, these things all create upward pressure on goods and services, which appears as inflation. So a lot of work has been done. The quantitative easing programs have been, you know, very aggressively, they're being reduced right now. Interest rates very aggressively raised. And those are the sort of normal toolkits from canonical models of economics. So what is the toolkit to fight inflation? And we've been very aggressive on those things.
Amazing, thank you. And just to elaborate on this further, how do different investor expectations on rates and yield curves perhaps feed into this or factor into this after a decade of predictable and persistently low rates?
Yeah, so that's a very good question because, you know, obviously people like myself who are in our 50s and older, we lived through inflationary pressures in the 70s and 80s and we know how much damage it can do. There's obviously a lot of a lack of understanding or lack of familiarity with inflation because many young people have gotten to their 40s without ever having to experience an inflationary environment. Inflation is incredibly damaging and challenging for businesses. They don't know if they hire a person today, how much are they going to cost in 6 months? Because if there's inflation, their price of higher wages will be increasing. Our ability to invest, so you might say today I'm going to build a house or I'm going to lay out a railway, and today it might cost you £100, but in an inflationary environment in 2 weeks' time or in a month's time or 6 months' time, it could cost you double that. And so those are the considerations that we have to think about. From an investor's perspective, there are a lot of questions in changing portfolios. Obviously, a higher interest rate environment is seen by many market participants as killing off economic growth, again, to try and tampen down demand so we don't have the inflationary pressures we've been talking about. But what that also does is that if there's no growth, then corporations, different, you know, small businesses, but also families are worried about investing into the future because you want to be investing into a growth expanding economy. And that can be very damaging in terms of obviously a society, because that means you're struggling to grow. But also from a portfolio perspective, it means people are more likely to invest in bonds than they are to invest in stocks, and therefore fund new businesses of the future. But even bonds are not necessarily a safe bet, because although superficially it might look like you could get 5% by putting your money in the bank, when you think about taxation and you think about other considerations around that investment, you might find that you're, and of course the inflation itself, you might find that you're not generating a return that is, you know, above the cost of capital. So very, very a lot of changing dynamics right now. I think from a board perspective, as I serve on a lot of corporate boards, but also from a government perspective, because I'm in the House of Lords and we are looking at issues around investment and growth for the future, there are real considerations to be, you know, be had about how do we spur growth, how do we encourage economic growth, how do we encourage investment in an environment where borrowing is so expensive, and people are worried about not generating returns if the growth picture is as weak as it is.
Amazing, thank you. And continuing with the topic of interest rates, S&P Global have reported that the need to refinance maturing corporate debt globally with interest rates remaining high has led to concerns of rising corporate defaults in 2024.
Yes.
So which sectors do you think are the most vulnerable to this, and what do you foresee happening?
Well, everyone is vulnerable because if you have debt, particularly debt that's becoming due in the near term, you then have to pay a higher interest expense, and obviously there are real concerns about the ability to find and finance the interest, not even the principal, just the interest of this debt, especially if you're not generating revenue or increasing a tax base. I say everyone should be concerned. Governments are already very worried. In the United States, for example, there's concerns that the interest expense, just the interest that the U.S. government is paying, is now bigger than the defense budget of the U.S. government. That's a real dislocation that can be quite worrisome. But within corporations, I mean, obviously companies are looking at their maturity profiles. One of the standout sectors that a lot of people are going to be focused on in 2024 is real estate, particularly commercial real estate. On the one hand, because interest rates have gone up, if you're a landlord, you have to pay a bigger mortgage, especially if you've got a floating rate back to the banks. But on the other hand, you're not generating enough revenue because people are not renting your buildings, for example, because they're working from home, or for other considerations. People are worried about growth, and so they're not starting their businesses. So there is a lot right now of a multi-trillion dollar risk associated with the commercial property markets in 2024. But that is by no means the only sector. The boards that I serve on, the companies that I'm involved with, are all looking at their maturity profiles. And obviously the obvious point within what I just said is that the fact that the banks are also holding the debt, so they are the ones who lend to these property owners and landlords. They too, that means the banking sector also has to think about making sure that they can remain solid through the challenges that may continue to occur in a high interest rate environment.
Of course. And Europe is facing its worst IPO market in a decade, and the bulk of companies in the IPO pipeline are tech startups backed by venture capital funds. What is your take on the outlook for equities, venture capital, and the IPO market more generally?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, because I think it's also going to be very quite challenged. As you may be aware, in 2020, as we were coming out of the pandemic, there were still a lot of capital, particularly from venture capital firms, that were funding startup businesses. But now we've had about 2 to 3 years of runway. And what's happening now is that the companies, the startups, are running out of money, and usually, in some instances, often, I should say, companies, startups, will try and refinance themselves maybe every 3 to 5 years. So now we're getting to a place where they've run down the money that they raised from the venture capital fund in 2020, and in 2024, there's a big expectation that there could be a lot of technology startups that have run out of runway, because basically they've run out of the venture capital money, and given that interest rates have gone up so much in the past 12 months, and the environment remains weak from an economics perspective, economic growth perspective, and adding to that the inflationary pressures, they're worried about being able to refinance or to re-up the venture capital investments. And so I think there is a lot of people, particularly people involved very heavily in Silicon Valley, are worried that we could see a lot of bankruptcies and failures of the startup industry in 2024.
Right. Thank you for your insights there. So now moving on to something slightly different. According to JP Morgan, increasing geopolitical risks have become the new normal. And this is illustrated by the impact of the Russia-Ukraine and now the Israeli-Hamas conflicts on energy markets. How might this instability mold the landscape of investment, both opportunities and strategy, for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, so quite fundamentally, I mean, in every sector, obviously real estate in the local environments that we've talked about, how people think about investing in the local environments changes materially. But from a global perspective, there are also real implications. Foodstuffs, wheat, Ukraine, but Russia also are both big exporters to many countries, developed and developing countries. So that's a dislocation that's been created by the war. Energy markets heavily disrupted because of bars and restrictions put on Russian exports, but real repricing going on with swing states like Saudi Arabia, Turkey, India, trying to play a role as brokers in a new energy regime. And then think about critical minerals. As we think about the energy transition and concerns around climate change, we need to figure out where are these minerals that are going to be very important in EV, sort of electric vehicles, but also in replacing and upgrading the energy markets. And all of these are affected by not just the trading corridors of and moving of goods and services, but also just whether or not we're getting along with our neighbors. There have been enormous geopolitical fissures, you know, as you know, between the US and China, which also feed into Western countries and China. But also beyond just those two, the real considerations around the BRICS reconstituting. So this is led by Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. In January 2024, they will expand to be 11 states, and those 11 states will represent about 40% of the world's population, but also represent about 36% of world GDP. Their ability to really alter the prices of food and critical minerals and energy will be quite considerable. And this is why the COP28 meeting, which is coming up in a few weeks, is going to be very challenged, I believe, because although there's a lot of acknowledgement that we need to do more on climate, I think that the geopolitical demands and tensions could make it much more difficult to come up with some way forward in the given the negotiations.
And continuing with the topic of energy markets, so in the landscape of global energy transitioning from fast development to decarbonisation and now energy security, you advocated for nuclear energy to become part of the green taxonomy in your maiden speech and argued it's crucial to Britain's energy security. So how does nuclear energy investment align with and advance these shifting priorities within the green framework?
Well, so I have a science background, and we're being challenged by an enormous range of challenges right now. We've got slow growth, we've got massive inequality in the world, we have therefore a lot of poverty, we have two wars, we have a post-pandemic era, which has left governments quite strapped for cash with enormous debt. We have a lot of other social challenges, including some of the things you just mentioned. We have climate change headwinds. We have the risk of a jobless underclass coming from technology. We have debt. We have enormous geopolitical fissures on the backdrop of demographic shifts. Today, according to the International Rescue Commission, we have the most number of refugees ever recorded in history, about 80 million. And so on and so forth. And so why do I mention this? It's not for us to be despondent, it's for us to realize that we need to find solutions, the best solutions wherever we can. We should not second guess ourselves and say, well, we're not gonna go down that road. A priori, not going to make an effort to look into those options. Because given where we are today, we have a long way to go and we've got a lot of challenges. As I mentioned earlier, we're consuming 100 million barrels of oil every single day. 80% of those barrels of oil come from fossil fuels, types, forms of energy. And the environment for investing in many renewable energy proposed areas is no longer cost effective, even with subsidies. And so we have to be open-minded, we have to be realistic about what we're dealing with. So we've got a massive amount of demand. The world's population continues to grow. The IEA has said that they think that we're going to see some softening in global demand, but I can assure you that we've got 1.5 billion people who today don't have access to energy on a clean and sustained basis. I do believe that we have an opportunity to explore, and the environment, the works that I do through the House of Lords and through the corporate boards in which I serve are looking at a whole list of options to address climate as one example. So we're looking at solar, wind, geothermal, biofuels, nuclear, we're looking at batteries. We're very open-minded about what the solution could be to reduce the climate change risks and get us closer to the 1.5 or even 2% targets in the near future. But that requires us being sensible about what is required. And so it's a long-winded way of saying I'm 100% supportive of something that's going to get us to the solution. We've got too many people who don't have access to energy. They cannot go to school because there's no lights. You know, we should be investing in better solutions, absolutely. But I do think that, thinking about nuclear in the suite of green is absolutely sensible, and it's the right thing to do, given that we have a very urgent and very large problem around climate, and it's coming quickly, and we have a lot of people that are struggling, and at the same time, a lot of governments that don't have the capital and the ability to invest in some of these in new investments, whether it's in emerging countries or developed countries that are continuing to suffer under enormous amounts of debt and a very challenged fiscus.
Right, thank you so much. And pivoting to the topic of AI, how do you think AI and other technological advancements will impact growth and human development?
Well, I hope positively. I mean, one of the things that I remain very optimistic about is technology's ability to bail us out of problems. As you may know, the late 1700s, Thomas Malthus said, oh gosh, you know, the population growth is going to cause a lot of problems around energy dislocations, and that he was predicting a lot of challenges because of lack of natural resources. That was repeated in the 1970s with the Club of Rome. They also said, oh, we're going to have a shortage of resources, we're going to have essentially then we had peak oil arguments. But in each of these cases, new technologies emerged, and those technologies helped us get better and actually helped society to move forward. So I remain very optimistic about what AI and generative AI in particular could do to make a lot of the problems that we're dealing with and talking about today go away, or at least mitigate for them. But having said that, I'm not naive. I know that there are risks, and in an environment where geopolitics is so fractured, militarily, technologically, and economically, there's a real risk that we don't get to good answers quickly because there's so much fighting and splinternet for a tug of war for technological superiority. But I do believe that if AI can deliver, we could have enormous productivity gains. But that still means that there are a lot of questions on what is the role of the economy, how does the economy function in a laborless growth model. In other words, where we might be getting many more gains in productivity that would require fewer human workers. Businesses could be altered where we have many more gains accrued to people who own capital, fewer gains to people who own labor, for again the reasons I just outlined. Government could change. The role of government, the scope of government could change in a world where there is a reduction in need for workers. What is the role of government in that environment? We have to reevaluate very assertively taxation and welfare once again, thinking about this in a world where we don't need that many human workers. And then of course, the calculus has changed around the rogue states and cyber risks. And so AI has the potential to be enormously impactful. You've seen some of the estimates. You have McKinsey, the consulting firm, estimating that you could get up to $4 trillion of gains, and certainly in profits. Goldman Sachs has talked about $7 trillion per year. Over time, in the next few years, around AI gains. So the jury's still out. I will tell you that technological gains, our productivity gains from technology, the story's not that clear, that it's unidirectional. We've had a lot of technology gains. If you think about the last 10 years, we've had Internet of Things, we've had crypto, we've had lots of technological gains from even just the microprocessor, etc. In the last 5 to 10 years, there have been real concerns that we've not benefited in terms of productivity, notwithstanding the changes in technology. So I remain optimistic, and I think a lot of people who know much more deep tech than I am have said that this is like fire to man, and it could be incredibly transformational. But these things take time, hopefully it will be there will be gains that can be spread around the world in a more equitable fashion than we've seen. And I've already highlighted some of the things we need to be careful about in creating further inequalities for society.
And you've touched on this briefly already, but what roles should corporations and governments play in mitigating and managing these opportunities and risks that you've mentioned, and what challenges might hinder the practical implementation of these actions?
Yeah, I mean, let me start with the second part of your question. I think the big concern for a lot of people who are more on the innovative side is that we get so scared of what might possibly be that we start to over-regulate, over-risk mitigate for scenarios, and therefore we very quickly end up in a situation where we're in a straitjacket and we don't get any of the benefits from productivity. On the other hand, of course, government should be involved in a way to support not just the financing of these new ideas, but also to support from a regulatory framework to make sure that people are doing the right things and that we're not causing harm in society. It's a very delicate balance. And I think that sometimes, there's a concern that you could end up with very cultural differences that emerge between regions. So when we think about the energy sector, for example, to shorthand it, there's a concern. It's not just the energy sector, many other sectors, technology, pharmaceuticals, etc., a concern that in Europe, there's a sort of glass half empty perspective. In other words, we're very focused on risk mitigation first, heavy regulation, etc., whereas in places like the United States, which tend to be much more focused on innovation, they think about investment first. And so getting that balance right, because obviously both places need both things. They both need some risk mitigation and regulation, but they also both need to be able to encourage innovation. Getting that right can be tricky, and we want to make sure that we don't over-regulate and therefore kill off any opportunities for investment and innovation to take hold. But I think that's really a big area, not just in AI and technology, but in the energy sector and in trying to address some of the big headwinds that the world faces.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I'll now move on to some questions more directly about your career. So you joined the board of Barclays in 2010, right after the 2008 global financial crisis.
Yes.
Within the Audit and Financial Committee, or Financial Risk Committee.
Yes.
So how do you think banks are dealing with duration risk differently relative to pre-crisis trends, given that we saw Silicon Valley Bank file for bankruptcy on similar grounds earlier this year?
Well, so first of all, a lot has changed just in terms of bank balance sheets. If you look at bank balance sheets today versus where they were in 2008, it's tremendously different. They have many more capital requirements, and the manner in which governments and banks think about risk mitigation has changed considerably. When I was on the Barclays board, for example, we reduced our exposure to Africa. Personally, as somebody who was born in Africa, it was very hard to see. It's sad to see because I know how much investment capital is necessary. But from a regulatory framework, there's something called G-SIFIs. These are globally significant financial institutions. There was an assessment that for those types of global banks, there's a much more sort of bigger exposure to knock-on effects and some of the things that we saw during the financial crisis. And so we chose to reduce that footprint. And many other banks did the same thing. So it's not a Barclays thing. It was a changing environment in terms of how we think about risk mitigation, but also think about managing different opportunities. Just to your question about duration management, you've just picked one specific risk that banks face. We face interest rate risk, we face credit risk, who's on the other side, who borrowed the money, and then of course duration risk, as you rightly highlighted. I think what gets lost with a lot of the sort of headlines, and this is where nuance is really important for business leaders, for public policy leaders, is understanding how people get to their decisions. In the case of Silicon Valley Bank, I am not on that board. I'm not even have a bank account there. But it's been interesting to hear the CEO former CEO of Silicon Valley Bank be interviewed by the American policymakers, saying, "What happened? Why did you get this wrong? It's such a fundamental core to managing a portfolio, managing a bank assets." And his answer, it wasn't exactly like this, but he was basically saying it's because he believed what the Fed chairman had said. The Fed chairman had initially said that they thought that the inflation problem was going to be temporary and the interest rate rises, which ultimately created the duration exposure, we're going to be short-term. We're not going to be we're not going to expect it to see interest rate rises for a long period of time. That decision obviously got the bank, and not just Silicon Valley Bank, many other banks and many other financial institutions took that information and decided to run their portfolios based on that. So again, to pick on one bank, I think we lose the broader perspective of how difficult it is to make decisions in the moment. If the Fed chairman tells you that inflation is going to be temporary and interest rates are not going to be going up for a long period of time, if you take that on face value and you manage your portfolio based on that, then you do run the risk and exposure that Silicon Valley Bank subsequently has had. There are other aspects of the Silicon Valley case that I don't know, and I wasn't there in the room, but from what I've heard, this was a big piece of their decision making. I would just say that the key takeaway, I think, for people is to understand that we as decision makers, whether you're in business, whether you're in the third sector, in NGOs, or whether you are in public policy, you make decisions based on the information that you have. And sometimes there are blind spots, or sometimes the information changes. Chairman Powell has subsequently now basically said, the problem of inflation is much more sticky. We've raised interest rates by 500 basis points, or 5%, over a relatively short period of time, very consistently high interest rate hikes. And we still have an inflation rate that's above the 2% target. So clearly, there's been a shift in the understanding of what that not just interest rate risk, but ultimately duration risk might be. So we make decisions based on information that we have at a particular time. When those things change, we're vulnerable. When those assumptions change, and so it's a matter of being on top of these things, and it can be very difficult sometimes.
And you have held positions in both the private and public sectors, served on various company boards during the global financial crisis, Brexit and the pandemic, and you are now a Baroness in the House of Lords. So could you share with us what key lessons or insights have you gained from your diverse and illustrious career?
Yes, so I think the main one is what I just said, which is that we need to be very flexible in the choices that we make. I myself was the chairman of the risk committee for SAB Miller, which used to trade on the FTSE 100 here in London. And, it was a wonderful role, but I was asked two things. They said, do you think the country's going to have a referendum for Brexit? And if we do have a referendum on Brexit, do you think we're going to vote to leave? I said no to both. And we formed decisions in the company based on those assumptions. And those assumptions seemed perfectly plausible at the time. We were looking at YouGov data. We're looking at not just at surveys. We're talking to very smart people. And most people did not think we were going to have a referendum, nor did they think if we did have a referendum, we'd vote Brexit. We were wrong. Real consequences to that. Nobody expected there to be a pandemic in 2020. If you look at a lot of the minutes or the annual reports just before March, early March 2020, a lot of people had very optimistic goals about what was going to happen in 2020. We thought there was going to be more growth. We were very optimistic about globalization and what could happen in the world. Well, guess what happened? Unbeknownst to us, we had to change course materially, the way people worked, how they worked. But also governments had to think about thinking about their own fiscal situation, funding the people working from home, thinking about their own programs to deliver healthcare solutions in a very challenged environment. We now know that there are second order effects around impact on education, impact on civil life, impact on mental health after that. But again, if you had spoken to me in February 2020, it wasn't on my radar. So the point is, the takeaway for people who are ultimately will be leaders in business, in public policy, in NGOs, is that we want to get that fine balance right of understanding that things can change on a dime and you have to move directions, and how do you make sure that the organization can survive through a very challenged environment that you might not expect. It's very different if you expect something. People say there's going to be a slowdown and you start to manage your business that way. Very different from waking up, you know, on the from the 9th of October, sorry, the 6th of October, the 7th of October of 2023, and finding out that actually the Middle East is now in a very vulnerable place. It's very challenging for public policy leaders and for business leaders as well. So for me, that's a very big lesson, is being open-minded, understanding what levers you have to change direction very quickly. And also just understanding that there's, you know, these different entities, I'm packaging them as being quite distinct, but what happens in government affects business, what happens in business affects the NGO sector. And I think for too long, certainly the last 20 years, there's been this culture that's emerged of pitting different groups against each other. You know, if you're talking to NGOs about energy, they don't want to be in the same room as an energy company. Or, you know, the government doesn't want to talk to big business. That's absurd. We need all hands on deck. Everybody needs to be rolling up their sleeves and saying, what do you know about this problem? How can we work together? I think one of our greatest disadvantages now around the world is that we've become so anti other people's views, other people, other organizations. It's to our detriment. You know, who knows better how to put carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen together to create oil? People who've been doing it for 30 years, those people could be in government, they could be in private sector, they could be in an NGO. We should have them all in the same room talking about what solutions could look like. This pitting each other against each other is the worst thing that can happen, and at the worst time, given all the things that the world is facing today.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. And as a penultimate question, so the House of Lords has a gender ratio of 3 men for every woman, with the average age of a lord being 71 years and almost 70% having received private education as of 2022. So how can more voices of women and people of color be heard in positions of power?
Performance. It's as simple as that. You know, I am more and more, as I get older, I realize that nobody's going to do you any favors just because you're a woman, just because you're black, just because you're from Africa. So what? I didn't really make those choices. They're nice to haves, but ultimately, given the changes that the world is facing today, we need all hands on deck, as I said. People are looking for great ideas from wherever they come from. And I think a lot of the narrative of discrimination, of gender discrimination, obviously race discrimination, those things they're absolutely part and parcel of society, and we should not stand for them. But at the same time, as young people, you should be leaning in with your best abilities. We've got to solve the climate challenge. We've got to solve poverty. We've got to solve issues around AI. And it doesn't, in a sense, of course, bringing yourself to those questions, your perspective, different, diverse understanding is always going to be incredibly helpful. But we're looking for solutions. People don't want naysayers. People don't want people who are going to just create more problems. And so the good news is that there's so many talented women, so many talented minorities. They're now showing up, and I love hiring them. I love hiring them, bringing them into the House of Lords, bringing them into academia. I'm on the Oxford University Endowment. Bringing them into corporate boards, because they roll up their sleeves. They never talk about, oh, actually, I'm here because I'm a woman or because I'm black or I'm from Africa. They are coming with ideas that can help us solve all the challenges that we've raised. Absolutely, there's racism. Absolutely, there's discrimination of gender. No doubt about it. But there are the people will still rise to the top who are going to be able to contribute and help move society forward. So I remain an eternal optimist. I really believe that nobody's going to do you any favors. When I get interviewed, nobody asks me, what does it feel like being a black woman from Africa? They go straight into, you're an economist. What do you think about interest rates? What do you think about global economy growth? What can we be doing? Because the world needs us to solve these things at scale. Do I worry about discrimination? Of course I do. I have, you know, nephews and nieces that look like me. But I think of all the periods that certainly in my lifetime, I'm over 50 now, but you know, looking back on history, this is the best time to really showcase each of our best abilities to contribute to the challenges, solving the challenges that the world faces. You know, in the 70s when women didn't have rights, a lot of those things have now become either legally unacceptable and even go back to civil rights for blacks, legally unacceptable or socially unacceptable. I don't go into boardrooms where there are no women or there are no minorities. It's unheard of. Companies would be ashamed to have a board like that. So let's get excited about the fact that there's finally a real opportunity and aperture to change things. You know, we've brought in some young people into the House of Lords. I mean, the youngest is 30, but we have a lot of 30-something years old and 40-something. They're bringing in ideas, male and female, bringing in real ideas about AI. The 70-year-olds don't know about that. That's what we need. That's what the country needs. It needs new ideas, and bringing in young people with those ideas is absolutely number one, most important. And you know, and I think that that's what we should be leaning in.
Thank you so much. And finally, a question we ask all economists on our podcast: what gives you hope?
Oh, so what gives me hope? I think the most important thing for me, a big driver, is technology. As I said, time and time again, just when I think many different generations think, oh my gosh, it's going to be the end of us, technology shows up. It delivers penicillin at scale. It creates the tractor, and you know, to move agriculture forward. It creates energy and national so natural resources. Solutions that were not anticipated. You know, in 1900, 60% of Americans were involved in agriculture. Today, it's less than 3%. So the whole economy has shifted. They've moved from agriculture to manufacturing into the service sector, and now there's scope for R&D. I'm not saying that these transitions are easy, but society moves forward. New technologies mean that there are new opportunities, new jobs, new opportunities and for engagement and for excellence. And so I'm, you know, my great regret is that I won't be here 100 years from now to see what happens, but I'm eternally optimistic that, you know, managed properly with the right balance of investment versus risk mitigation, we should all be very euphoric about what the world could be. We're going to solve, you know, we were able to bring a COVID vaccine in a fraction of the time. That's technology. That's decades, it's years and years of people doing science and technology in places that we don't even see them. But they solve a lot of problems on food production and on energy delivery and renewables. We should be excited about what technology can do. So that's what gives me a lot of hope.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for taking the time to appear on our podcast. It's been an incredible pleasure hearing you.
Thank you.
And your insights on various different topics.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed being here very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Beverage Report podcast, interviewing Baroness Dambisa Moyo. To find out more about Lady Moyo and what she is working on, as well as other speeches, interviews, and appearances, you can find her on various platforms such as X and Instagram. If you've found this episode interesting, please tune in to our other episodes on Spotify or on our website. And if you have any suggestions or feedback for us, please reach out over email to beverage.report@lse.ac.uk. Thanks again, and goodbye.